Shalom, welcome to SJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chasdai, Pesach Ben Dov, Meir Ben Yecheskel, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers, I want to speak about the past week because it was, again, a good week and a week of progress for our movement. First of all, Shlomo did two cartoons which we released, and the cartoons, I think, were quite a success. One of the cartoons was about my Aliyah, where you saw a picture of me and various facts about me written under the picture that Shlomo drew of me. And then next to that, against that, Yasser Arafat, Yimash Shmo V'Zichro, the Arab Hitler, and various facts written about him and how I was expelled from Israel and I'm not allowed to go to Israel, whereas Arafat was welcomed into Israel. And all of the details of all the horrible things Arafat did, how he murdered thousands of Jews and hundreds of Americans, how he always called for the extermination of all non-Muslim infidels, how he always called for the destruction of Israel, how he murdered another 1,500 Jews even after he was admitted into Israel under the so-called Oslo agreements. All of these facts are brought up, I think, in a very effective way. And the cartoon, I think, very effectively explained what an outrage, what an injustice, what an obscenity it was to expel me and to continue to expel me from the land of Israel, an expulsion that is done by the same Israeli governments that welcomed Arafat and welcomed 80,000 Arab Muslim Nazi terrorists into the land of Israel. Arab Muslim Nazi armed terrorists were welcomed into the land of Israel. Now, just to see what that cartoon did. On our Hebrew Facebook page, on our main Hebrew Facebook page, we have two, but on our main Hebrew Facebook, we actually have several Hebrew Facebook pages, but on our main Hebrew Facebook page alone, 1,392 people decided to look at the post. So we had 1,392 views. 75 people liked it. We have likes from 75 people. 18 other Facebook pages shared it. It was shared on 18 other Facebook pages. So, this is what we see just from our main Hebrew Facebook page. Almost 1,400 views, 75 likes, 18 other Facebook pages decided to put it on their page. On our English Facebook page, our main English Facebook page, again, we have several English Facebook pages, but on our main English Facebook page, 1,455 people saw the post, or decided to look at the post. 22 likes. Okay? And 153 other Facebook pages shared it. Now that's, why did we get so many Facebook pages sharing it? That's primarily because of the great Dan Ben Noach. The great Dan Ben Noach, I don't know how he does it, but he goes to all these pages and he got us all of these shares. So we have 153 other Facebook pages that share the video, and the vast majority of that is thanks to the great Dan Ben Noach. And that's on our English Facebook page. By the way, if you notice, when Dan Ben Noach and Irish Zionist, when those two are with us, we do much better in every area. When they're not with us, and they're not with us all year round, because they have other things that they have to do in their lives, so they're not always with us. Sometimes they're not with us for extended periods of time. But when they are with us, when they're with us, when Dan Ben Noach is with us, and when Irish Zionist is with us, we always do much better. I mean, those two are such great people. Hashem should bless them and their loved ones. What fantastic, magnificent human beings. What fantastic, magnificent, saintly people. And I'm so proud that we attract that type of quality leadership to our forum. They are true leaders in every sense of the word. Now, what does this mean, the statistics that I just cited to you? It means that thousands of new people have been introduced to the issue of the injustice that was done to me when I was denied the right to go to Israel, and when Arafat and 80,000 terrorists were accepted into Israel by the same Israeli government that threw me out and has kept me out for 18 years now. Thousands of new people were introduced to this. Thousands of Israeli Jews who maybe didn't know about it or who didn't understand the extent of the injustice were exposed to this. Thousands of new people just from one cartoon. I think that's an accomplishment. And then Shlomo, the brilliant Shlomo, did another excellent cartoon on Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman. He's Netanyahu's foreign minister, very corrupt and disgusting individual who pretends to be a right winger, and the media, the Bolshevik media in Israel actually even calls him an extreme right winger. When in fact, he proposes total Israeli national suicide. He says, for instance, that Israel should accept the Obama-Kerry plan for national suicide to go back to the pre-1967 borders that are only 6 to 9 miles wide and to surrender Jerusalem, Israel's eternal capital city. That's what Lieberman has publicly said Israel should do. And he's described as a right winger? A traitor like that that advocates total Israeli suicide, and he's described as a right winger? And so we did a cartoon on that explaining what he stands for. And in the cartoon, we show a picture of Lieberman looking into the mirror, and you see Yariv Oppenheimer. We discussed this on last week's SJTF. But I just want to share some statistics with you. On the English Facebook page, 1,894 people saw it. 1,894 people decided to look at that in their timeline. On the English Facebook page. And 145 other Facebook pages are sharing the cartoon we did on Lieberman. Again, that's mostly, most of those Facebook shares are because of the great Dan Ben-Noach. But still, that helps us in the search engines, and it helps us, and who knows how many people on those other Facebook pages, who knows how many people are being exposed to it. And so, those are just two cartoons that were done, that we put out this week, or this past week. And I think that those cartoons, together with the videos, together with all the other things that we're posting, especially on the Hebrew Facebook page, where there are new posts going up every day, new posts go up, and all types of new information and facts go up. And I haven't even told you about, on my own personal page, I have my own personal page with almost 1,100 likes, and there's activity on my own personal page as well. And I haven't even discussed with you the other Hebrew and English Facebook pages that we have. We do have, yes, we have other Hebrew and English Facebook pages as well. So I think overall you get the picture that we're reaching thousands of people every week. Thousands of people. Through Facebook, through YouTube, through all the other things that we're doing, we reach thousands of people. We have an audience of thousands of people right now. We have thousands of likes. That means everybody who gets a like automatically receives in their timeline whatever new thing we're putting up. Anyone who likes what we're doing immediately receives in their timeline. I think we have 5,000 or 6,000 likes. I don't remember exactly. But all of those people receive in their timeline whatever new thing we're posting up. Plus, they can share it with other people, which we urge them to do. Plus, as you see from this, all types of other Facebook pages are sharing and publicizing what we're doing. So thousands of people, we now, our audience every week is thousands of people, including thousands of Israeli Jews, which creates the basis, the foundation for something in Israel, for a movement. It's not the huge movement that we want and that we need, but we have a basis here for something. We have an audience, and we have a basis, and we have followers, and we have something here that's real. Now, we need to increase that to tens of thousands. When we can reach tens of thousands every week, and when we have tens of thousands of likes every week, God willing, Bezrat Hashem, that it should only be, we should, God willing, have that. Once we reach tens of thousands, and we're growing all the time, so eventually that will happen, then we become a major force. Of course, hundreds of thousands, we'd be a mass movement in Israel. And I'm talking about Israel now. Hundreds of thousands in a country of just 6 million Jews, you're a mass movement already. You're already someone who can potentially take over the government eventually. But even tens of thousands were a big enough force to run for the Knesset and to be a serious force that people have to listen to in Israel. If we have tens of thousands, because tens of thousands in a country of only 6 million Jews, again, that's That's a substantial group of people for a small country like Israel. So that's our goal. Our goal is to eventually reach 10,000 and 20,000, 30,000, those types of numbers. That's our goal. That's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy. We have, for instance, 1,829 likes right now on our main Hebrew page. So we've got to dramatically increase that. And so we're going to begin an advertising campaign, God willing, on Facebook. We're going to start advertising on Facebook. They offer us all the time advertising, and we're going to try it. We're going to try an advertising campaign. Some great JTFers we've already received a number of contributions. We've received generous contributions from some great JTFers. And we're ready to begin advertising very, very soon. We're going to begin advertising. We're going to try to figure out what would be the best way. I'm still studying, by the way, all of the rules and all of the suggestions of how you advertise effectively. We're going to try various things. We can advertise a certain amount one day and then have a daily budget and change. You're allowed to change your advertising at any time. So we may adjust it. We may try different things, which is what you do in an effective advertising campaign. Here we have the power. It's not like television where you put the commercial on. It's too late to cancel it once it's already running, or to change it once it's already running. You got to cut a new commercial, and television is more complicated. Here, you can change what you have in your ad campaign at any time. Those are the rules on Facebook for advertising, because they want to encourage advertising. And so we're going to give it a run, and we're going to see what happens. We hope to increase. I hope we dramatically increase the number of people. We hope to increase it. I don't think just the advertising campaign by itself will bring us tens of thousands. That I don't expect. But I'm hoping we get a boost. And the more we're boosted and the more we grow and the more we gain, as we've been gaining every week, the more people we reach, the better it is and the stronger we get until we reach our goal. You give me tens of thousands of active people backing us, and then we become a force to be reckoned with in Israel. If I have tens of thousands of Israeli Jews actively backing us, even if it's just on Facebook, that's a force to be reckoned with. It's something to be considered in Israel. And it gives us power to be able to go into the political process with some power behind us. And so, that's our strategy. That's what we've been doing. I think it's been an encouraging week. Again, a week of progress, a week where we achieved some important things. I hope to be able to continue to report to you about progress. I want our great JTFers to know when we do make progress. And, you know, and I give you an honest report. I mean, there are times when things are good, there are times when things aren't so good. On the English Forum, for instance, I don't think things are so good. I think on the English Forum, there's less activity than there was last year, I guess because of the presidential campaign, there was much more activity on the forum. So there's less activity than there was in the past on the English Forum. Fewer people are involved. I know that a lot of people come and visit the forum, but in terms of actually writing and putting things up, there's less than there was in the past. It's not the end of the world. The forum isn't falling apart. But on the English forum, not on the Facebook page, but on the English forum, that's something that, you know, where we can use some improvement. But in any event, overall, in terms of our reaching people, because wherever we reach people, it's good. In terms of our reach overall, when you count the Facebook pages, is very good right now. I mean, comparatively speaking, thousands of people are getting our message. That's building the nucleus of a movement, of a political movement that can make a difference, God willing. At least we hope so. And so we need your help. We need your help to reach as many people as we can. We need your help to move the ball as quickly as we can. When you see us put up cartoons or videos, whether the videos are in English or in Hebrew, doesn't matter. When you see us put these cartoons and videos up, help us promote them on Facebook, on YouTube, everywhere. Like the cartoons on Facebook, and like them on Facebook and on YouTube, of course. Share them on your pages. Comment and favorite the videos on YouTube. So whether it's cartoons or videos, whether it's on Facebook or YouTube. You know all of the terms, like, share, comment, favorite. You know what the terms are. Important to do all of that. That promotes and boosts the cartoons and or the videos in the search engines. Also, of course, we need good threads and posts on the forums and on the Facebook pages. Please do not get into petty personal disputes and arguments on the forum. Our people have been better behaved lately. We've had some trolls that have come on and have tried to start some disputes. I think our people have behaved very, generally speaking, our people have behaved well and have handled it well. But let's keep in mind that how well we're behaved and how disciplined we are in terms of the forum and in terms of how in terms of the Facebook pages and how we present ourselves and the type of quality threads and posts that we put up, that's what will attract new people. And we want, and the name of the game is to attract people and to get more people involved with us and to spread our message as much as possible. That's the name of the game. We want to spread the message. And so, aside from promoting the cartoons and videos, we need good threads and posts on the forums and Facebook pages. And last but not least, of course, we need your financial support to advertise, to spread the word, to reach our goals, to become a major force as quickly as possible. Checks, money orders, cash donations sent to our post office box, of course, help. Every single donation makes a big difference. It really does. God bless the great JTFers that have been helping us. God bless them and their loved ones, their family. God bless them. By the way, that's for the post office box, checks, money orders, and cash donations. As far as the donate buttons, unfortunately, the donate button only works on the Hebrew site now, on the Hebrew main page now, which is hayamin.org. You have to go to hayamin.org for the donate button. The donate button on the English main page is no longer operable because the company that was hosting us is going out of business. They're not going to be in the business anymore of hosting that type of hosting online credit card payments. That's unfortunate, but because the company, they was a pretty good company for us. But they're no longer going to be in that business. So the English donate button is no longer operable, no longer works. Only the Hebrew donate button now works. So you have to go to the Hebrew page. There's a donate button in English on top. If you want to make a donation with your credit card conveniently online. It all helps. And again, we have some great JTFers that have been helping us. We got a wonderful response. I put up a thread asking people to help us with the advertising campaign on Facebook, and we got a wonderful response from a number of great JTFers. God bless you. We're going to try our best. I can't guarantee success with advertising. You know, with advertising, you never know for sure until you do it. But we're going to try our best. We're going to try our best, and let's hope that it gives us the boost that we're looking for. I am, as you could tell, I'm very upbeat and pleased with what happened this past week. It gives me hope that we can move forward and gain a bigger and bigger audience and reach more and more people and have a bigger movement so that we could become more of a force for good in the land of Israel. And if we become a bigger force in the land of Israel, eventually that influence and power will spread to the United States as well, God willing. All right, let's go now to our questions from our great JTFers. And we start with, let me just make sure I'm on the right browser here. Yes, I'm on the right browser. And we start with the great Wandering Samurai 81, who writes, and I quote, "Dear Chaim, is cancer less deadly now than it was 20 years ago?" Unquote. Of course, cancer is less deadly now than it was 3 or 4 years ago. They're constantly making new advances, thank God, Baruch Hashem, in cancer, heart disease, and all the illnesses. There have been major strides in medical science, so of course it's less deadly. You know, when I say less deadly, it would be more accurate to say, is there a better chance of surviving once, God forbid, lo aleinu, which means it shouldn't be upon us, lo aleinu, if cancer is detected in someone, is there a better chance of surviving? In most types of cancers, yes, in most types of cancers, there are some cancers where the progress has been greater than others. Lung cancer, for instance, is a cancer where unfortunately the vast majority of people who have lung cancer do not survive very long. Lung cancer is a very deadly cancer. Tumors, lo aleno, are something that usually kill people. If it's a malignant tumor that someone has in their head, usually that winds up killing somebody. So there are certain areas where they still need to make a lot more progress, but there are other areas where tremendous progress has been made. And, you know, we have to keep, of course, we have to keep pushing, and hopefully, cures will be found, and eventually this will be cured completely, God willing. There is no doubt the day will come when cancer will be cured and will be a thing of the past. And now a wandering samurai writes, and I quote, "And speaking of which, please pray for my sister Tracy. Please hope and pray that this scourge called breast cancer doesn't return," unquote. Absolutely, wandering samurai. All of us should pray for wandering samurai sister Tracy, that she should have a refuah shlema, complete recovery. God should give her a complete recovery. And wandering samurai, please urge your sister to have a healthy diet, to exercise, and not to, you know, not to be aggravated, and you know, to live a life where she doesn't have a tremendous amount of aggravation all the time, and where she has a healthy diet, and where she does plenty of exercise. That's good. That's good not just for cancer. That's good for every aspect of living. And yes, we should all be praying for Tracy and for all the victims of this terrible disease, all the good people who are victims of this terrible disease. Thank you, Wandering Samurai. And we now go to our great friend Yamashmo to John Kerry, who writes, and I quote, "One, is Russian military action in Crimea justifiable because Crimea historically belongs to Russia," unquote. You know, nothing really historically belongs to anybody in that part of the world. It's all military force and violence and corruption and murder. I don't like either side in that conflict. I don't like the Ukrainians or the Russians because they spent centuries murdering the Jewish people, both of them. The Ukrainians, during the Holocaust, enthusiastically supported Hitler and the Nazis and murdered hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian Jews. And the Russians, I think we know their history of pogroms and persecution and all types of vicious anti-Semitism for centuries in Russia, under the Tsars and then, of course, when the Bolsheviks took over, and the terrible things that the communists did to the Jewish people for so many years in Russia. And to this day, what is Vladimir Putin doing? He's trying to build nuclear weapons for Muslim terrorist Iran, but he wants to build nuclear weapons and still give Russia deniability, but he's still giving them the technology. So he's enabling them to build nuclear weapons. So Russia has always been an enemy of the Jewish people, is still an enemy of the Jewish people. The Ukrainians, of course, murderous enemies of the Jewish people. So in that fight between Russia and the Ukraine, I'll tell you the truth, I don't like either side. Now Yamashmo to John Kerry writes, and I quote, "Expose Zhirinovsky." Okay. Well, I think most of our members are familiar with Vladimir Zhirinovsky. He, Yemach Shmo v'zichro, may his name and memory be obliterated. This is someone who had a Polish-Jewish father, and his mother was not Jewish, so he's not Jewish, but he had a Polish-Jewish father, and so that makes him filled with hatred for his father and filled with hatred for the Jewish people. You know, these individuals that are products of mixed marriages usually wind up being the worst anti-Semites. They wind up hating the Jewish people with a passion, and this is just an example. I mean, this guy, Zhirinovsky, is a Nazi Jew hater. He blames all of Russia's problems on the Jews. Everything that goes wrong in Russia, he always blames on the Jews, this filthy animal. And just the lowest of the low. And by the way, Vladimir Putin works with him. He works with Vladimir Putin. He worked with the communists. Before that, he was identifying himself as a Jew in the 1980s when the communists were in power. he headed a some I forgot what it was called, but he headed an organ, a Jewish organization to prove that the Soviets are not anti-Semitic. This was when JDL was bombing the Soviets, and they desperately wanted to, they were on the defensive, and they desperately wanted to show that they're not anti-Semitic. Zhirinovsky was involved in some communist Jewish front group to prove that, no, you see, the Jews live well in Russia. So he worked with the communists. And, he, I mean, he's also supports, he's also a Nazi. He'll work with anybody. And now he's, he, the truth is that he has an arrangement with Putin where he sometimes says things and tests the waters for various things Putin eventually wants to do. He makes statements and tests the waters and sees what the reaction is for Putin. That's his role. But there's no question he's working with Putin. And, okay, and Yamash Shmota John Kerry now writes, 3, Ted Cruz called Putin KGB thug, unquote. Obviously he's a KGB thug. He was a colonel in the KGB. Of course he's a KGB thug. First of all KGB agents are thugs. The KGB is the Soviet Gestapo. It's a monstrous organization. They were part of a regime that murdered millions and millions of people. Monsters. And Putin is a continuation of that monstrous apparatus that's where he started his career in the KGB, and he has never left. He is 100% KGB to this day. That's like being in the Soviet SS. So Ted Cruz is 100% correct. Thank you, Yamash Shmota John Kerry. And now we go to the great Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, who was the worst president in United States history, Bill Clinton or the Muslim Obama, unquote. Well, you mentioned certainly two of the worst. Some people don't realize how bad Bill Clinton was, but he actually opened the door to a lot of terrible policies, which we never really saw the effects of them until after he left office. But one of those policies was giving cheap mortgages to black people who don't work. And he did that. Jimmy Carter started that, and he really accelerated that process. And as a result of that, we saw the collapse of the mortgage industry and of the housing industry in the United States. Terrible economic problems because of what Bill Clinton did. He created all types of economic bubbles. He also created bureaucracies and made changes in government that we're suffering for to this day. He also lowered the standards of American morality so dramatically. One of the reasons we're such an immoral, disgusting, the majority of Americans accept such immoral, disgusting things is because of Bill Clinton. He started us on that process. Bill and Hillary Clinton. One of their themes in office was that morals don't count. Doesn't matter if he's cheating on his wife. It doesn't matter if he's sexually assaulting women and raping women like he did with Juanita Broderick. Bill Clinton is a rapist, by the way. He raped Juanita Broderick. That doesn't matter. As long as he's supposedly doing a good job as president, which he wasn't doing a good job as president either. But they said this doesn't matter. What he does in his personal life, if he rapes, if he commits adultery, if he commits all these other crimes, if he attacks a 21-year-old girl in his office, that doesn't matter. Those things don't matter. They're irrelevant. And even if there are financial scandals, which Hillary Clinton was involved with many financial scandals when she was first lady and even when she was in Arkansas, that doesn't count either. Corruption is doesn't matter if someone is corrupt, doesn't matter if someone is evil, doesn't matter if someone is immoral. None of those things matter. Well, we see that it does matter. Because the American people, their standards have been lowered by this, and they have learned to accept evil behavior because of the Clintons. But despite all the terrible things that the Clintons did, I think Obama actually probably is even worse than Bill Clinton. Hillary Clinton, I don't know. Hillary Clinton may be just as bad, if not worse, than Obama. I think that she would be absolutely terrible. But so far, I think it is possible to say that Obama might be the worst president we've had yet, because he is literally destroying this country. Whether it's gay marriage or Obamacare or amnesty or ignoring the rule of law and just issuing executive orders like a dictator. The things this guy is doing are things that generations of Americans will suffer for. He really is endangering the very survival of the United States in the worst way possible. So right now I would say Obama and Jimmy Carter, you left out Jimmy Carter. I would say Obama and Jimmy Carter are probably tied for having been the two worst presidents in American history. Thank you, Joe Gutfeld. And we now go to the great Chicago Jew who writes, and I quote, "Do you know Avi Lipkin and what is your opinion of him?" Unquote. I have seen some of his stuff on the internet. I've seen some of his stuff on the internet. And he has spent a lifetime with the Israeli establishment. He worked with Yitzhak Shamir, who was working with Shimon Peres, the worst people in the Israeli establishment. He was part of that. He worked for the Israeli establishment, which automatically should be a signal. Our antenna should go up. When someone works with the establishment, our antenna should go up. Not always, but in most cases, that's a bad sign. But then he decided he was going to run on a political party in Israel, and he's formed a political party in Israel, that advocates assimilationist policies. He advocates assimilationist policies on his political party in Israel. He says Israel is part of the West and we all have to mold in and become part of the Western world. That is not what the role of Israel should be. Israel is supposed to be a holy nation, a chosen people, a light unto the nations. So I don't think he's a good force as far as the Jewish people are concerned. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And we now go to our great friend Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, "Approximately what year did the State Department become Bolshevik?" Unquote. Oh, I think the State Department, for many, many years, maybe 200 years, I don't know exactly, but for many, many years, the State Department has been a treasonous department of the government. And the reason, I think one of the reasons is diplomacy tends to attract people who think you can work things out with the most evil monsters, with Hitler, with Stalin, with the devil himself. You just go and negotiate and everything is going to be fine. You just sit down and work everything out. And of course, if you have that mentality, if you think that you can sit down with Hitler and cut deals with Hitler and Stalin and all these other monsters, then what you're doing is evil. What you're doing is monstrous. You're going to be selling innocent people out when you do that. And that is the mentality of most people who get into diplomacy. Not everybody, but most people in diplomacy. So diplomacy lends itself to that type of treasonous behavior, that type of immoral behavior. The State Department itself, for many, many years, has been a terrible branch of the U.S. government. I'm not saying, of course, in the days of George Washington and John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and John Quincy Adams, the State Department then was, you know, then we had a federal government that was properly serving the American people, and we had presidents who were doing what American presidents are supposed to do. So I'm not talking about in the days of the Founding Fathers, but pretty quickly after that, you saw the diplomatic corps take over. And when they take over, people with that diplomatic mentality who go to Ivy League universities or educated abroad in Ivy League universities, that people with that mentality tend to be bad people with a bad influence on policy. Binyamin now writes, and I quote, "What do you think of, one, Shai Ben Tekoa," unquote. Well, I don't know him very well. I don't know him well enough to give you an absolute definitive answer, but from what I've seen, and I did see his website once, what I've seen, he seems to be saying things that are pretty good. Again, I don't know him. I don't want to tell people this is the guy, this is a great guy, because, you know, there may be something I don't know. Because I don't know many details. I'm just saying, that what I've seen in a superficial way, just superficially looking, he seems to be saying good things. So I give him the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to assume that he's a good Jew, because he seems to be saying things that are good. There's no Palestinian people. And some of the things he says there seem, some of the things he's been saying, or that I've seen him say on the internet, seem to be pretty good. So my impression of him so far is a positive impression, even though, again, I don't know enough, and I've never met him, and I don't know enough to make a final determination, but my impression of him, just from what I've seen, seems to be that he's saying good things, and he seems to be a pretty positive person. Binyamin now writes, and I quote, too, Republican Pennsylvania Governor Corbett, unquote. I think Corbett is part of the Republican establishment. I think he stinks. I hate the Republican establishment. That's why we support Ted Cruz. We hate the Republican establishment. But I will do anything to support Corbett. I will gladly, if I lived in Pennsylvania, I'd vote for him with both hands. I would gladly vote for Corbett against Tom Wolf or one of these other self-hating Jews that will probably win the Democrat primary to oppose Corbett, because Corbett's opponent will probably be a self-hating Jew. And unfortunately, that Corbett, according to the polls, Corbett is going to lose in November. He's not popular in Pennsylvania. And the most likely candidate, according to the polls now, is Tom Wolf, who is a disgusting self-hating Jew, who is buying the election. He's one, another one of these Jewish multimillionaires or billionaires or whatever they are. You know, he's a multimillionaire, I think. I don't think he's worth billions, but he's worth a lot. And he's pouring millions of his own money into the campaign, running television commercials, and he's already has a big lead in the Democrat primary for governor of Pennsylvania. And he's a disgusting left-wing, self-hating Jew involved with every left-wing, with Obama, with Hillary Clinton, with every left-wing disgusting cause. So I certainly will support Governor Corbett against that self-hating Jew. That's for sure, against Tom Wolf, or I forgot the name of the other one, the congresswoman that's running. You would know better than me, Binyamin, because you're more familiar with Pennsylvania than I am. But there's a Jewish congresswoman there that's running. I forgot what her name is. She's another one. She's running against Tom Wolf. Either one of them would be a disaster. Let's hope that a Gentile wins the Democrat primary for governor. By the way, if there are any Democrats in Pennsylvania, please vote for the Gentile candidate. Vote for the Gentile candidate with the best chance of beating Tom Wolf and beating the self-hating Jews in that primary. And in November, definitely vote for Governor Corbett against his Democrat opponent, if his Democrat opponent is a self-hating Jew. Thank you, Binyamin. And we now go to the great Mensch, who writes, and I quote, Russians were not counted, but numbers included Ukrainians living in Russia. East Ukrainians heroically fought, while Polizei SS division were overwhelmingly from Galicia. Okay, Mensch, that makes sense that's true. First of all, the fact that Ukrainians who live in Russia were in the Red Army, that's not impressive. Everybody in Russia, was subject to the draft. People were drafted. The Russians drafted as many people as they could in World War II. They were fighting a desperate battle. I mean, they almost lost. It was a very, very, very tough war. And one of the reasons it was a tough war, the Germans by themselves could never have done to Russia what they did, if not for the fact that they had a lot of supporters, that the Ukrainians, the Latvians, Lithuanians, the Estonians, all types of groups of people within what was then the Soviet Union were supporting the German Nazis when they came there. That's how the German Nazis were able to achieve what they achieved, and they nearly won the war because of that. There was a point where they moved all the way, they were going to take Moscow. I mean, they nearly won the war. But the fact that Ukrainians served in the Red Army, I'm referring to something Mansch wrote last week about Ukrainians serving in the army and fighting in the Red Army. Of course Ukrainians served in the Red Army, they were drafted. And even the Ukrainians who lived in Ukraine were subject to the draft. Everyone was subject to the draft. Anywhere in the Soviet Union, you would be subject to being drafted. As far as the East Ukrainians fighting more than the, there's so much mix. There's so many mix. There's so, such mixed up It's such a mixed up situation there, Mensch. I don't know which East Ukrainians are Russians. I'm talking about Russians living in Ukraine now. Okay? You know that in eastern Ukraine, there is a very large population of Russian speaking people, and they consider themselves to be Russian. A very large number of East Ukrainians consider themselves to be Russian. They're Russian speaking, and their origins are Russian. Because Lenin and Stalin and Khrushchev and the other Russian dictators sent Russians to those republics, to the Ukraine, to even to the southern republics, even to places like Georgia. They deliberately sent Russian, ethnic Russians there in order to maintain Soviet control over those areas, as you well know. And especially in Ukraine, they did that. There was an aggressive Soviet policy of moving and settling Russians in Ukraine. So I don't know who is of Russian origin, who is not, and what statistics, you know, you can use all types of statistics. What I do know is that the Ukrainian nationalists and the Ukrainians who wanted independence and those Ukrainians supported the German Nazis fanatically, fought with the German Nazis enthusiastically, marched with them, had parades for them, welcomed them, gave them all types of gifts when they came, and the women welcomed them, and everybody welcomed them. I mean, that's just a fact. Of course, more of them are going to be from Galicia, and more of them are going to be from Western Ukraine, obviously, because the farther away you are from Central Russia, the lower the percentage of ethnic Russians you're going to have in the population, and the more Ukrainian nationalists you're going to have. But still, the history of the Ukrainians is a history. Those who were nationalists, those who were ethnically Ukrainian and proud to be ethnically Ukrainian, their history is that they supported the German Nazis. They murdered huge numbers of Jews in Babi Yar and elsewhere, and their history is a terrible history of murderous Nazi anti-Semitism. Thank you, Mensch. And we now go to our great friend Lewinsky Stinks, Dr. Brennan Rocks, who writes, and I quote, please discuss the beautiful righteous Gentile Anne Barnhart, who has bigger cojones than most bull elephants, unquote. Absolutely. Anne Barnhart is a wonderful person. She's an evangelical Christian who strongly supports Israel, very strongly and aggressively supports Israel, and she's a real conservative who really fights for conservative principles. She is truly a righteous Gentile. She's also, you're right, she's also a beautiful woman and a righteous Gentile. You're absolutely right. And she definitely is very courageous. There's no question about that. There's no question about that. I'd like us to work with her. I think that she's someone we should be working with. I mean, she's the type of person that we should be working with. She's a very good person. And now Lewinsky Stinks writes, and I quote, also discuss the great, quote-unquote, John Leibovitz. You mean the John Leibovitz from the Federal Trade Commission? Obama's appointee at the Federal Trade Commission, that guy? Who's married to Ruth Marcus of the Washington Post? I don't know if you're referring to the same one that I'm thinking of. The John Leibovitz I know. And maybe this is why you put the great in quotes. The John Leibovitz I know is a horrible, left-wing, self-hating piece of subhuman garbage who's married to the other piece of subhuman garbage, Ruth Marcus, the columnist for the Washington Nazi Post, who writes columns about Israel has to be flexible and Obama means well. Oh, Obama's a real friend of Israel. Obama's very good. Those Republicans are terrible. Oh, Obama's wonderful. That's who he's married to. And he himself is very active. He's very active in the Democrat Party and supporting Obama, supporting Hillary Clinton, supporting all of the vermin. So, what can I say? I hope he and his wife... let me put it to you this way. I hope that God decides to take action against him and his wife someday. Let's put it that way. I hope God decides that their presence in this world is not a positive thing. That's what I think of John Leibovitz, yimach shmo. Thank you, Lewinsky Stinks. And now we go to the great Moshe Mike Ben-Avi, who writes, and I quote, "What is your opinion about the Nazi Jordanian parliament who condemned Israel for killing a terrorist in the Allenby checkpoint after their soldiers more than once claimed insanity?" Unquote. Okay, let's start with that. Yeah, absolutely. The Jordanian Nazi parliament is just like the parliament of Nazi Germany. They unanimously pass resolutions supporting every Arab murderer and Arab terrorist. You know, the Arab terrorist who murdered those six Israeli Jewish girls in 1999, the Jordanian parliament unanimously passed a resolution calling them heroes, calling the Jordanian soldier who murdered those seven Israeli Jewish girls a hero. They passed a resolution calling someone who murdered 12-year-old Jewish girls, unarmed 12-year-old Jewish girls who came to visit, and he gunned them down and butchered them. They called him a hero. They said, that's heroic. Unanimously. That's the Jordanian parliament. Here, this is a terrorist in the Allenby checkpoint. He of course, intended to murder Jewish soldiers and murder any Jew who he could find. Israeli soldiers defended themselves. And the Jordanian parliament unanimously condemns Israel and praises the Arab terrorist. So this is what we're dealing with in Jordan. This is the game they play. By the way, the king of Jordan, the parliament would not act without the consent of the king of Jordan. The king of Jordan, that filthy, miserable pig king, is also part of this. He tells the Jordanian parliament, okay, yes, you can do this. This is okay. He's part of it. There's no question. They don't act on their own. They don't have a real parliament and real elections and real... And Jordan is a dictatorship. It's a monarchy and a dictatorship. And the great Moshe Mike Ben-Avi now writes, "Why did Bibi apologize to this people instead of praising the soldiers for defending themselves?" Unquote. Yeah, that's another big issue here. Bibi Netanyahu right away apologized. Apologized. The Israeli soldiers defend themselves against an Arab terrorist who comes to murder them. And Bibi apologizes that the Israeli soldiers lived. This is like apologizing that we're breathing or that we're living. It's so disgusting. Bibi also apologized to Turkey. Turkey wants to smuggle weapons to Gaza to help Hamas, and Bibi apologizes to the Muslim Nazi terrorist dictator of Turkey. Bibi apologizes to everybody. The only people he doesn't apologize to are the Jews whom he stabs in the back, which he's done all of his life. Great points, Moshe. Absolutely great points. Yishar koach. She'ela metzuyenet. Great points. Ve'heyara metzuyenet. Thank you, Moshe. And now we go to our great friend Kalman ben Menachem, who writes, and I quote, "Reb Chaim, what do you think of conservative activist and former leftist David Horowitz?" Thank you, unquote. I don't think he's a former leftist. I think he's just a phony. He joined our forum to tell us, some of our members, some JTFers approached him and said, why don't we work together? He said, oh no. He said, I've seen Chaim ben Pesach. I saw what they wrote about him. I'm unacceptable to Dave. My past is something that's just too much for David Horowitz. This is a guy who was a member of the Communist Party, which slavishly worked for Joseph Stalin, for the Soviet Union, during the Cold War, working for the enemy of the United States. Horowitz wrote in his biography, in his autobiography, that he and his parents, when they were members of the Communist Party, and they were all members of the Communist Party, that when they were members of the Communist Party, they considered themselves to be like spies for the Soviet Union. This is Horowitz's words. So it's okay for him and his family to have been communists working to enslave the whole world and destroy the whole world under Stalinism. That's okay. That doesn't bother Horowitz. That, you know, now he says he's changed and so on and so forth, but still, that's his past. He says, my past is so terrible that he couldn't work with me. Why? Because I fought against the Soviets and fought against communism. And yes, bombed your Soviet friends, Horowitz. I bombed and destroyed their property because they were torturing and murdering my people, while you and your family were supporting the torturers and murderers of our people. The blood of Soviet Jews is on the hands of every Jew who was a communist. The Jews who were members of the Communist Party, you murdered your fellow Jews. Aside from murdering many other people as well. By being part of that evil, monstrous movement. And he had the nerve to say, oh, Chaim ben Pesach with his past? Oh, no. I don't want to have anything. I'm not going to work with him. So, Kalman, I don't like David Horowitz. He's a fake. Thank you, Kalman. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, who writes, and I quote, one. By the way, Dr. Dan is the voice of reason, common sense, and logic. And Dr. Dan writes, and I quote, one. There is a time for peace when peace. Okay, or when is there peace? Well, of course there's a time. Of course there's a time for peace. Peace is when you've defeated evil. That's the only time that there could be peace. You can have a situation of no war because evil people are so afraid they don't dare to start war with you. But real, true peace only comes when evil is completely defeated. That's the only time you can have real, true peace. Until then, the best you can do is deter war, prevent war, avert war, and deter war by being so strong that your enemies wouldn't dare to start with you. And that should be the policies of Israel and of every other country that wants to avoid war. Dr. Dan now writes, two, talk about famous anti-Semites and self-haters who turn pro-Israel, unquote. Well, I'll give you one example that I think many people on the forum have heard me speak about before. I'll give you one example. And that's Jesse Helms. Jesse Helms was a television talk show host in North Carolina, a conservative television talk show host. He was a segregationist. He opposed the civil rights movement. He was very right-wing. But he also was anti-Semitic, and he admitted it. He later on admitted that he had anti-Semitic feelings, and, you know, he changed later on, but he admitted that he had anti-Semitic views. He made statements that were anti-Israel when he first got elected to the U.S. Senate from North Carolina. And he was someone who was an enemy. Until the Kahanish Jews got in touch with him and met him. And he was very impressed with Rabbi Kahana. He never met Rabbi Kahana, but he was impressed with Rabbi Kahana and the Kahanish Jews. And we did meet with him. We went to his office and we met with him. And he was very impressed with us. And when we went to him, we quoted the Bible, because he was an evangelical Christian. He hated the Jews because he met so many Jewish leftists who, you know, let's face it, the Jewish leftists are not likable people. You know, they're not a lovable people, these self-hating Jewish leftists. They're disgusting. So because of them, he hated the Jews in general. But we said to him that despite the fact that there are a lot of self-hating Jewish leftists, you're still obligated as a whole to support the Jewish people in the state of Israel and God's Zionist enterprise in the land of Israel. And we went there armed with scriptures and, you know, with scriptures from the Bible and explained that to him. And he was agreeing with us. And he loved, before we came, he decided to look up and study some of the things Rabbi Kahana stood for. And he was very impressed with Rabbi Kahana. He loved Rabbi Kahana because Rabbi Kahana was more right-wing than he was. So, you know, he was very impressed with Rabbi Kahana. And he became pro-Israel after that. All of a sudden, he started getting together with other senators who also had been against Israel because they felt the Jews are a bunch of leftists, screw the Jews, we don't want to, you know. He started getting together with other senators and started, and all of a sudden he wrote letters to the Israeli government and started speaking in the Senate. saying Israel should not give up one inch of the land that Judea and Samaria and Jerusalem and the Golan Heights and all the land of Israel belongs to the state of Israel and the Jewish people because God gave it to the Jewish people and the state of Israel. He became the most pro-Israel member of the Senate. And when I was starving in the prison system and they weren't giving me kosher food, I and members of my family wrote to every Jewish congressman and senator, Chuck Schumer, all of them. Not one of them did anything meaningful to help. Not one of them. Jesse Helms not only got involved, he called up the head of the Bureau of Prisons, and I saw this from the Freedom of Information Act from my file, and I saw my file from the Bureau of Prisons, so they let me see my file because I filed for a Freedom of Information right to see it. Jesse Helms spoke to the director of the Bureau of Prisons and said that he would hold up the whole budget for the whole Federal Bureau of Prisons if they didn't give me kosher food. The guy in the Bureau of Prisons said, well, I'm not familiar with the case. Let me get back to you, Senator. And he went back and he found out that a deformed so-called rabbi was saying, no, the food is kosher. It's not pork. It's okay. He can eat it. It's kosher. Which, of course, it wasn't. He was a deformed so-called rabbi. Oh, what a piece of subhuman. This so-called deformed rabbi was allowing the black Hebrews to call themselves Jews, and he was saying, oh, they're Jews too. Yes, they're Jews. They say they're Jews, they're Jews. He was telling the Bureau of Prisons to accept them also as Jews on the kosher line, the black Hebrews, who say that all whites are devils. And that the real Jews are black. Mm-hmm. And the deformed rabbi was saying, oh, no, they're right, they're right. Yes, no, they're right. The original Jews, they were all black. You're right, you're absolutely right. He was going along with that, this piece of subhuman, you know what. Anyway, so Jesse Helms saw that, you know, so the head of the Bureau of Prisons said, well, we have a rabbi who says that no, that it is kosher, that it's okay, and that, you know, that this inmate, meaning me, you know, he's complaining, he shouldn't be complaining, it's all right. We have a rabbi saying it's okay. So Jesse Helms found out it's a deformed so-called rabbi, and he already by then knew more because he started learning about this stuff. And he said, that is not a real rabbi. You get a real rabbi over there, and you make sure that he gets kosher food or I'll hold up the whole Bureau of Prisons budget. And all of a sudden, they pulled me out. They put me in. They punished me because I wanted kosher food. They put me in solitary confinement. They pulled me out of solitary confinement. And started feeding me for the first time. They started feeding me and giving me, and they bought TV dinners and other, you know, I mean, it wasn't fancy, but that, you know, I'm in prison. I don't expect fancy food. I didn't want fancy food. I just wanted to survive. And all of a sudden they started feeding me because they were scared when Jesse Helms got involved. That was someone who was an anti-Semite. Because he met the self-hating Jews, but when he met the Kahanas Jews, he became our biggest supporter. Thank you, Dr. Dan. And now we go to the great Russian Leo 777, who writes, and I quote, Putin doesn't care what the world thinks. Why can't Israel turn off electricity, food, water shipments to Gaza to starve the Muslim Nazi enemy, unquote. You're absolutely right. We should learn from Putin. I mean, Putin is an evil man, but we should learn from him. He at least has the guts to do what he wants to do. Israel should do that. There's no question about that. It's completely insane. Israel gives all of these things, electricity, food, water shipments to Gaza. Not just to Gaza, to Judea and Samaria, to all the Arabs in the land of Israel. They give them this for free. Jews don't get any of this for free. Jews have to pay very high prices. They pay much higher bills because the Arabs get it all subsidized for free. So that of course increases the amount of money the Jews have to pay. Because the Jews never get anything for free. But the Israeli government gives this to the Arab Nazis who murder Jews for free. If we're in power, only if we're in power, all of that will end and end immediately. And then you'll see the Arabs desperately wanting to get out of Israel. Thank you, Russian Leo. And now we go to The great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, Purim, why was attending the party such a devastating thing, unquote? Okay, that's a good question. That's a question about the Mishteh. It's called Mishteh. It was called the Mishteh. How do you translate Mishteh? Mishteh comes from like a drinking party, you know, party where they serve drinks. It's a fancy way of saying a party where they serve drinks. The king of Persia, Ahasuerus, decided that he was going to hold this party. And the Jews went. Now, why was that so terrible? That's what the Tag Mechir is asking. Very good question. The answer is because the king of Persia had a new strategy for governing his huge empire. He conquered and controlled 127 nations, including Israel, including the Israel and the Jewish people. 127 nations were under the control of the Persian Empire. And his strategy was to give each nation relative religious autonomy, not to force them to become like Persians, because he knew that that wasn't realistic. He decided instead, let's keep them happy. This way they won't rebel, they'll pay us taxes, they'll allow us to be the rulers of the empire, but meanwhile they'll have their autonomy, they'll think that they're in effect independent, they'll just pay us taxes, but they'll have religious autonomy and national so-called autonomy. We'll respect each nation, we'll respect their religion and their culture, but meanwhile we will be the sovereigns and they'll pay us taxes. That was his strategy. In other words, to be a benevolent emperor, a benevolent dictator, a benevolent ruler over 127 nations. This is the most dangerous form of galut for the Jewish people, of exile for the Jewish people, because the Jews were exiled to Persia. And the most dangerous form of exile is when the nations that we're exiled among are good to us. When they're good to us and nice to us, like the United States today or Western countries, when they're good to us and nice to us and let us have economic advancement and become wealthy and success, that is the worst type of galut, because then the Jews assimilate en masse. Then you have massive assimilation and intermarriage and the Jewish people disappear. And it's the destruction of the Jewish people, and you have a spiritual holocaust when that happens. King Ahasuerus invited the representatives of all 127 nations to a huge party that lasted for 180 days, for a half a year, to feed them, to honor them, including the Jews. Ahasuerus gave the Jews kosher food, glatt kosher food, and honored them at the party when it was time for the Jews. He honored each of the 127 nations when it was time for the Jews to be honored. He gave them glatt kosher food. He honored their culture, their history. He said, oh, yes, you have a wonderful history. He respected them and honored them in their own language. And the Jews willingly participated and were celebrating. They were so happy that you have a ruler here who's so nice to us that they actually were celebrating the fact that they were in Persia. That was the sin. When Jews celebrate the fact that they're in any country other than the land of Israel, that is the worst type of sin. That is a terrible sin. That's like Avodah Zarah. That's like idolatry. That's like saying you don't believe in the God of Israel and you don't believe in the Torah. Because the Torah clearly states that our land is only the land of Israel. That's where we belong. Anywhere outside the land of Israel is a punishment. And if we say we enjoy the punishment, that is the worst type of rebellion against God. And that is what the Jews in Persia who went to that celebration of the Persian king were doing. They were willingly participating and celebrating with everybody else the Persian Empire. And the Persian Empire included conquest of the land of Israel. And they were celebrating it. In effect, they were celebrating their exile. This is like the Jews in America today who say, you know, I'm so grateful to be in America. What a wonderful place. It's so wonderful. And they celebrate Thanksgiving and celebrate the 4th of July and celebrate all these other holidays. Now, let me explain something to you. Thanksgiving is a wonderful holiday. A wonderful holiday for Gentiles. And the 4th of July is a wonderful holiday for Gentiles. And America is a beautiful country. a wonderful country for Gentiles. Jews must live in Israel. Jews do not belong here. It doesn't matter if it's the most wonderful country in the world. Jews are not allowed to live outside of Israel. It is a sin. And that's why God, right after that party, gave the Jews the great test of Purim with Haman and the danger that they were going to be exterminated, and Haman getting the king's consent to exterminate the Jews. That started because of the Jewish behavior at that party, celebrating the fact that they were in Persia, just as Jews who celebrate, who say, I'm so proud to be an American, and I live in America, and this is the country for me, and I'll never live anywhere else. Those Jews may not realize it, but they're committing a terrible, terrible sin. For a Gentile to say they're proud to be an American is very appropriate. Gentiles should be proud of their country and should be proud to be Americans, but Jews, because of the orders of God and the plan of God in the world to have the Jews as a special nation in the land of Israel, in the Holy Land, they are not allowed to be part of that. They are not allowed to be part of that. And that's why the exile in Persia was so devastating and so dangerous. And that's why the exile in America, we see the consequences. You had 6 million Jews living in America at one time. The vast majority of them are no longer Jewish. They don't think Jewish. They are self-hating. You can't even speak to them about Israel. They don't give a damn about anything Jewish. They actually hate their own people. That's the consequences. That's the consequences of an exile when our hosts in the host country are being nice to us and the Jews give in to that and decide to mix in, assimilate, intermarry, and so on. And now Tag Mechir Tzedek writes, for example, if the White House, say Reagan, invited Jews to come, are they to not attend, unquote. If Reagan invites them to the White House and says to them, you've got to celebrate the fact that you live in America and should be happy that you're living in America, that's right. They are not allowed to do that. Anybody, Ted Cruz, and we love Ted Cruz, but if Ted Cruz invited them, they're not allowed to do that. And by the way, Ted Cruz, I think, would agree with me because Ted Cruz is an evangelical Christian, and I think he knows that the Jews belong in Israel. That for the sake of the Jews and for the sake of the world, those Jews belong in Israel. They don't belong in America. But they're not allowed to do that. If someone invited, let's say, if you had a Ted Cruz and he invited JTF to the White House, yes, we would go. We'd go to the White House, sure. But we would not go to the White House to celebrate the fact that we're in America and to say we're glad to be in America and to say we're going to stay in America. That is not the purpose. We would go to the White House to urge Ted Cruz or urge any president to have policies that are appropriate from a biblical and Torah perspective. That's what we would go there for, to be a light unto the nations and a holy nation, a nation of priests. And a light unto the nations understands that you do what the Bible says, and the Bible says that the Jews belong in the land of Israel, only in the land of Israel. Thank you, Tag Mechir Tzedek. And now we go to the great Irish Zionist. God bless Irish Zionist. God bless Irish Zionist. All the great things that Irish Zionist does, all the great things Dan Ben Noach does. I'll tell you, those two are like they and Shlomo. Those three are like the pillars of our movement, of our movement in the United States. We have a movement in Israel, of course, with pillars in Israel as well. But in America, those three are really such great members. And we have, of course, we do have other great people. There's no question we have other great people here as well. Irish Zionist does so much for us, has done so much for us. God bless Irish Zionist. Irish Zionist now writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, can you tell us the story about when you disrupted the Soviet ballet to free Russian Jews? Also, was that the first mission that you did in JDL, unquote. No, it wasn't the first one. That was the disruption of the Soviet ballet was in 1986, on September 2nd, 1986. It was the Moiseyev Ballet. The first things that I did were actually way back in 1971, 15 years earlier when I was only 14 years old. And the reason I did things when I was 14 years old, it was easy for me to get in because nobody expected a 14-year-old kid who looked like he was 10 years old. I mean, I was embarrassing when I was 14. You know, kids, when you're 14, you always want to look older. And unfortunately, I looked like a little kid. And so nobody ever expected me to go in and do the things that I did. But No, I started the activities many years earlier. 1986, though, that was this incident with the Soviet Ballet, September 2nd, 1986, was probably the most important date in the campaign to free Soviet Jews. It was the incident that got more publicity for Soviet Jews than any other incident in the history of the movement. It was an incident where we released a tear gas canister at the Mosiev Ballet. First of all, Mayor Koch, the self-hating Jew, and the FBI and everybody else, they all insisted that they're going to guard this and that nobody's going to get in and they don't care if there are threats and so on. The Soviets have come back to start ballets in New York City and we're going to welcome them and nobody's, don't worry, we're going to make sure nobody can do anything in this ballet. We assure you, you're going to be safe and the ballet will go on. That's what they assured the public about. We got in with the tear gas canister. And we released a military tear gas canister. 4,000 people were forced to leave with tears in their eyes because the military tear gas canister kept shooting up very strong. It wasn't strong enough to really kill anybody, but you know, it made your eyes tear and it was uncomfortable and people had to leave. People had to run out. And what happened was the Soviets, though, the FBI came and told everybody you have to leave and started organizing everybody to leave. And so all 4,000 people in the audience left. But the Soviet diplomats who were there, including the Soviet ambassador to the United Nations in New York and the Soviet ambassador to Washington, they refused to leave. The Soviet diplomats and the leading Soviet ballet dancers, the main Soviet ballet dancers, they refused to leave. They said, we will not allow the Zionist hooligans to disrupt program. We will not allow this to happen. You know, they weren't going to allow that to happen. Okay. They stayed and refused to leave when the FBI told everybody to leave. And so they passed out eventually from the tear gas. They passed out and they were unconscious from the tear gas. And so ambulances had to come from hospitals and took 50 Soviet diplomats and ballet performers to the hospital, and they had to stay overnight. None of them was seriously injured, but still it was a big incident. Both Soviet ambassadors, the Soviet ambassador to the United States in Washington and the Soviet ambassador to the UN in New York, both Soviet ambassadors, the most important Soviet ambassadors in the world, were injured and had to stay overnight in the hospital because of a tear gas canister that's released by a Jewish group protesting Soviet policies. This was a huge international incident. The Soviet dictator, Mikhail Gorbachev, yimach shmo, hysterically condemned us and said this is severely damaging Soviet-American relations. And, of course, we were condemned by President Reagan and everybody else. And it was a huge story. But it was the final straw. This was the thing. We were bombing all over the place. We were blowing up Soviet cars and bombing Soviet property. But this was the incident that convinced the Soviets that they just could not get away with this. They were going to have to. They knew the Soviet Union was collapsing. But they intended to hold the Jews in Russia even after the Soviet Union collapses. They were going to, you know, they would have the same bureaucrats in charge. They were going to continue to hold the Jews there. They weren't going to let the Jews out. They weren't going to give the Jews visas to leave. The same communist bureaucrats were still in power when Yeltsin and all the other leaders that took over after Gorbachev was out of power. The same communist bureaucrats were still in power. They weren't going to change their policy. But they knew at this point they would have to. That they couldn't have orderly Soviet-American relations or Russian-American relations, which they would desperately need. They desperately had to have good relations with the West because their economy was collapsing. And they knew they wouldn't be able to get away with holding the Jews anymore when this happened. This was the thing that finally brought down the wall for Soviet Jews, to get the Soviet Jews out. This incident absolutely proved that their policies could not be sustained anymore. And it also pushed all the Jewish organizations and Jewish leaders into action on this issue. Gorbachev was coming here to visit President Reagan in late 1987. And the Jewish organization said, we're not going to embarrass our guest President Gorbachev, this vicious dictator, this vicious bloody animal. We're not going to embarrass him when he comes to visit. No, we're not going to have demonstrations when he comes to visit. No. After this incident, because I use the publicity I got from this incident to condemn these Jewish traitors all over the place and say, you were responsible for murdering 6 million Jews in the Holocaust because of your cowardly criminal silence, and now you're doing the same thing to our brothers and sisters in the Soviet Union. This was all over TV and radio and newspapers condemning these leaders. And so they were on the defensive, and so they did. After promising they wouldn't, they reversed themselves and did organize a mass demonstration, and 250,000 American Jews went to Washington to protest when Gorbachev came here. And it was because of the JDL. The B'nai B'rith monthly newspaper, the International Jewish Monthly, wrote, quote, JDL violence pushed Jewish leaders into action on the issue of Soviet Jewry. It was JDL violence that did it. That was in the April 1985 edition of the International Jewish Monthly. They admitted that. I mean, this was because of us that they had to take action. They couldn't ignore the issue anymore. It was all over the news. They couldn't pretend it wasn't there and let Gorbachev come and not protest. Everyone was expecting and demanding of them that they do something. And so they were forced to act. And so we got the Jewish leaders to act, the Jewish organizations to act. We got all of this machinery in motion so that the Soviets saw that there was no way they could continue to hold Soviet Jews hostage. And for the first time since the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, all Jews were allowed to leave. For the first time, all the doors were open and all Jews were allowed to leave, and hundreds of thousands left just in the early 1990s. And there are many more details about that incident. I could write a whole book just about this one incident. There's so many details, but I hope that gives you a little bit of a glimpse into what happened. Those were very exciting days. And days when one tear gas canister that would cost $100 changed Jewish history forever. Thank you, Irish Zionist. And we now go to the great Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, why did Hashem make man out of dust if Hashem wanted to make man in his image? Unquote. Because man is in God's image, the spiritual part of man, his neshama, his soul. That's the part of a human being that is in God's image. That's the part of a human being that has free will and has all of these other characteristics that that God also has. God also has free will. And so the part of a human being that is in God's image is the spiritual aspect of a human being. The body, which comes out of dust, that's not in God's image. God has no physical being. The whole physical world God created for our benefit, but God has no physical. God is absolutely perfect. There is no physical being for God. God is entirely spiritual. We can't understand it because we're physical beings, but we know that it's true. I mean, I'll give you an example of the difference between a human being's physical characteristics and his spiritual characteristics, or his soul, the difference. If a human being can see, you would say, because he opens his eyes and he sees through his eyes, right? But if someone dies, they still have eyes. They still have eyes, they still have, well, can they see anymore? They can't see anymore. They still have hands, but can they move their hands or can they feel anything? They can't. And so, can they breathe anymore even though they still have lungs? When someone is dead, they can't do that anymore. They still have all of those physical characteristics, but the eyes, the lungs, the mouth, the hands, all of the other aspects of their body can no longer move because their soul has been taken out of their body. It's their soul that gives them life and that enables them to use all of these parts of their body. And that soul, that is the part that Hashem made in his image. Thank you, Maimonides. And now we go to our great friend EB22, who writes, and I quote, outside of the JTF movement, in the last few months, have you seen anyone step up as a potential leadership solution in Israel? Unquote. Well, we have some differences of opinion, but I think Moshe Feiglin has been doing some things that are courageous. He's been fighting for the rights of Jews to pray at the Temple Mount. He has proposed a Kahanist-type solution, saying that we should pay the Arabs to leave Israel. He's done some things recently that he's also, by the way, trying to help me get into Israel. So I would say Moshe Feiglin has done some things that I would characterize as certainly better than anything we've seen since the days of Rabbi Kahana. Now, there are some areas where we may have some differences of opinion with him. There may be some areas where we differ with him. But I would say overall, he's the only one out of the 120 members of the Knesset that I think has done anything really that I could truly characterize as truly positive. Thank you, EB. And I enjoy doing another great program. It's a great program because of your great questions. And it's such an honor and a privilege to speak to the great people who have such great questions and great comments that are made every week. It's thanks to you. It's a great program and an interesting program. Until next week, Shalom.